We finished point one last week, so I think we're on track to be able to finish this time. If you recall, we finished point one of the men in part one, then we went exactly 9 points. We have 9 points for the women, which means we have 8 to go, and then a few remarks at the end. The last point we covered was for the women. We started point one for the women. Take care of the needs at home. That leads us to point two. Now, some of these almost sound like counterparts of the points to the men because they are the same point yet from the woman's perspective. So point two is this. Both mates cannot be in charge, ladies. Number two is both mates cannot be in charge. Now you'll recall, and we'll turn to Genesis chapter 3. Unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In sorrow you shall bring forth children, and your desire shall be to your husband, and he shall rule over you. God actually put within a woman's mind the natural inclination, unless otherwise programmed by society or environment or a bad mother or whatever, to look to her husband. Ladies, you were designed, you were engineered, if you will, by God to look to a man. It is your natural state of existence. It is not natural for this world. It is more natural for women to fight, to throw off the bonds of oppression, as they're told, that men have perpetrated upon them for generations. The reality is a lot of men, not understanding their role, as I explained in part one, have created an oppressive environment in marriages, which has certainly caused the devil to be happy, because what it naturally brings, for every action, as I explained, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Women were not made, nobody was made to be oppressed, to be crushed, to be ruled by a husband who is a kind of a Gentile lord over them. Therefore, since that is an unnatural reaction, women tend to throw off in an equal but opposite reaction, you know, the bands of oppression from their husbands in the marriages of this world. Literally, the period of Victorian prudery of the 19th century was a kind of a prophetic run-up to what God said would occur in Isaiah 3:12, and you don't have to turn there, you know the verse, about marriages at the end of the age. That in fact, children would be their oppressors and women rule over them. Women literally do rule marriages. Now in the church, I have seen a sort of what I call a kind of a Laodicean middle ground. It's not really a reflection of Laodicea, although maybe in one way it is, but it's a kind of a Laodicean middle ground where men know they're supposed to be in charge. God called them out of a world that had programmed them, subtly at least, to be under their wives and programmed their wives to sort of be at least equal and maybe a little more equal than their husbands. And so men kind of worked their way back, and I have seen this in the marriages of people in the church. Oh, have I seen it. And the man sort of adopts the position that we're kind of co-equal, but we'll say that I'm in charge. Now, this is done unwittingly, unknowingly, unconsciously. But the fact is that's what happens. I've seen it in the church. Now, of course, we know that the vast majority of people who are in the worldwide church of God were never converted. So the moment The physical understanding of the truth that Mr. Armstrong's life and presence and the literature sort of superimposed on their marriage, the moment that was gone, they reverted to exactly what was in the world. They never had God's Spirit. So 80% of the marriages in the church, at best, were a terrible example, sort of held in check by the presence of this great leader who had a work to do. But as in all other areas of life where people were not living the principles of the Bible from a spiritual perspective, but they were sort of ostensibly, outwardly, physically appearing to be part of the church. Marriages were the same. In the same way, marriages sort of appeared to be right side up, but in reality, spiritually, they were upside down. When Mr. Armstrong died, a vast wave of divorces began in the church. I'll talk more about that when I get into divorce and remarriage. All kinds of problems in marriage occurred. A very weak ministry no longer would teach what God says. I don't think most of them even any longer that much remembered what God said, so weren't about to teach it, and probably most of them never fully understood it, or they would have understood government correctly. I find one of the most remarkable things that ever happened, going back to worldwide for a moment, is how people in the name of government, which we now know they absolutely never understood, actually stayed in a place that taught all kinds of wrong doctrines because they thought they were, I emphasize, they thought they were following government. If they had really understood the government of God, these people who so strongly professed to understand it and used it to as an excuse to stay there, if they'd really understood government, they would have left immediately. And that same lack of understanding, that same blurred vision of how God works in the church or in marriages reflected it. And so they're gone. So off into the splinters went a great many people who had a blurred mixing of what God taught. Many of them, of course, have God's Spirit, and many don't. But we in the Church of God have to fully understand exactly how marriage works. If husbands oppress their wives, you'll have a miserable marriage. For two reasons. Number one, well, it won't be a miserable marriage necessarily very long. Women will either bolt or rebel and try to take charge, and the husband will capitulate. Now the husband is left with a decision. He will capitulate because he realizes, if I don't give this woman more authority, and sometimes the pendulum swings and he gives her too much, I'll lose my marriage. And of course, then there are just those husbands who continue to think like the world and they slowly implode. And pretty soon you see the wife's driving the car and doing everything. And the man hands over the reins of the marriage. This is also exacerbated a little bit by the fact, and God never intended it be this way, but it's an interesting fact that is part of what has happened in society. The average woman marries a man who was about 2.2 years older. The average woman outlives her husband by 7.7 years. So you now have the average woman outliving her husband, when you add the 2.2, 9.9, or we'll call it 10 years. Okay, against that backdrop, you have to realize, too, that husbands typically, because they don't take care of themselves, and Satan has worked out this sort of pattern, this condition and trend in the world, people don't exercise enough. Men tend to go to pieces faster because they get overweight. They don't understand that a man's strength is often defined by his physical strength. And so before the man dies, the woman knows two things. He's fading before he died. And number two, I'm going to be alone for 10 years on average. So what that does is it causes the woman, it's one additional reason, it causes the woman to begin to assert herself. Even in a marriage where it's been reasonably good, but she asserts herself sooner. The devil has set up the world so that he could destroy families at the fastest rate in all of history at the very end of the age. And in fact, that's what's happened. Now, God made the woman to be under the man. 1 Peter 3 makes its own statement about this. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 1. Then I want to make some concluding comments, because it's a little longer point before we go on to point 3. 1 Peter 3 and verse 1, "Likewise, you wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not a word," not the word, but a word from their husband, "they also may without the word be won by the conduct of the wives, while they behold your chaste conduct coupled with fear, whose adorning, let it not be that outward adorning of plaiting the hair and of wearing of gold or putting on of apparel, but let it be the hidden man of the heart in that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. Ladies, I cannot stress enough to you how God says, if you want to literally wear a crown of jewels, the way to do it, I didn't say this, Mr. Armstrong didn't say this, no other minister said it, God said, you should wear a meek and quiet spirit. There's no room for brassiness, indiscretion, a loud-mouthed approach. I'm in charge here, or I ought to have a bigger say. Yes, sometimes maybe your husband should give you a little bigger say in things, but the overall attitude cannot be that way. For after this manner, in the old time, the holy women also who trusted in God. Yes, sometimes when your husband is mishandling you, you have to trust God. They adorned themselves, being in subjection under their own husbands. They put on a garment. They adorned themselves, a beautiful dress that would be defined as subjection to your husband. Crowned with a magnificent crown called a meek and quiet spirit. Do you women see yourself dressed that way? Adorned themselves? It's not talking about the clothes they put on, any more than the reference to the hair is actual hair there, although in a way there was a problem. People in the first century church were coming to services with gold strands weaved into their hair. It was sort of a style. You know, remember when frosting came along and different things that women would do? There were all kinds of different hairstyles. Well, this is a hairstyle. And Peter used it to say, no, if you want to really wear something beautiful in your hair, not these strands of gold woven into your hair, wear a meek and quiet spirit. Even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. Yes, calling him Lord. Oh, I would never do that. Well, I don't say you should call your husband Lord, but you ought to at least think of him that way. You address him in that sense. Why? Whose daughters you are, as long as you do well and are not afraid with any amazement. Now, let me explain that. As long as you do well, we've just described some of the verses that define doing well. As long as you do that, you're one of Sarah's daughters. Now, we are all Abraham's children, but women, men are not Sarah's daughters, but converted women are Sarah's daughters. Have you ever stopped to realize that? Do you understand that, ladies? But you're only Sarah's daughters, in the same sense that men and all of us are Abraham's children, if you do well, and all that means in terms of Christianity, and are not afraid with any amazement. Now, the Greek there is alarm, or human worry. Now, if you're in a situation where it's past the point where you've got just little irritations with a husband who maybe isn't handling you exactly right, that's a different problem. That's a very different problem. Then you're alarmed. Now, if you're more serious, you've got a husband who is now not just marginally maybe too tough on you or unwise in leadership, but causes fright and fear and human worry. You know, you can't be that way. Sometimes, though, then it becomes a more serious problem, and counsel has to be sought. Now, let me make some final comments. Divorce is so rampant in our society because both mates, and we've now covered this in terms of the overall role of the husband and role of the wife that is not understood out there, divorce is so rampant in our society that it touches the church in all directions. There's so many people I deal with in the church. You talk to them, and they're divorced. A woman called me in another group, just bombed in her marriage, and she'd been disfellowshipped by a splinter group she was in, and she'd gone to another splinter group, and this had caused her to wonder which husband she was bound to, and so in the end, she just realized that somebody was wrong because this minister had disfellowshipped her, and she wanted to know what I thought about whether or not she was bound. I don't know her, and she's not in RCG. I don't know if she's coming with RCG. She seems to be reading some of our literature. I guess we'll see. But the point is, she wanted to know. I listened to her, and her mind was just scrambled up in certain ways about divorce and remarriage. She decided to throw aside everything that all ministers said, including Mr. Armstrong. She said, all these ministers are wrong, and she started studying and going into the subject of divorce and remarriage, and I just realized, oh, so scrambled. And it leads me to this comment. If you are the children of divorce, if you have been divorced, your wiring has been changed more than you know. Your fundamental ability to approach and your view of things around you is not the same. It's not what God intended. But you would not necessarily know that because it is your view. Your view of child rearing, your view of marriage, the opposite sex from either perspective, your ability to make fundamental judgments, handle money, do things that are common sense in life is rewired. And I don't mean for the best either. It changes you. If you have gone through a divorce or you've seen divorce, I've sometimes dealt with families where there's divorce in all directions as far as the eye can see. They're scrambled. I can't even counsel those people the same way. They don't understand the same kinds of basic concepts and common sense that other people do. And the only way I've learned to describe it is they're just wired differently. They're wired differently. They're not ruined. But sin has an effect. And marriage is so central to God's entire purpose of reproducing himself that when that aspect of a person's life gets skewed, fouled up with one, two, or three divorces, either as a product of divorce, and you didn't get both sides of the parenting above you, sometimes even becoming an orphan, didn't get either one, or you go through a divorce, and almost invariably that will seem to happen, the wiring is wrong. Please understand that you have to rewire yourself or you'll constantly be blowing circuits. You'll constantly be shorting out. It's almost literally like the dimming of a light. It'll kind of dim down and it doesn't see things in the same way until you correct the wiring problem or the short in the wires. That's why it's one of the great reasons, apart from all that marriage pictures, that divorce for any reason, and there are biblically prescribed reasons why God allows people to not be bound to other mates, we'll talk about that, to a previous mate, but it ought to be avoided like 10 forms of the plague. I couldn't say that 10, or let's say 20 and 30 years ago, but I've worked with and counseled so many hundreds of marriage problems of every conceivable size, shape, flavor, color, and texture that I have to tell you, brethren, divorce is wrong. And it all starts, all the wrong things that flow from divorce start with the fact that one or both mates in the marriage misunderstand God's intended role for each. Once that's violated, it's like being in a train, a switch was thrown. You're now on a different track. It doesn't make any difference whether you speed up, slow down, or even stop. You're on the wrong track. Eventually, the train will recognize, you know, those on the train, that husband and wife will recognize they're not going where they thought they were going. They may just be miserable. The marriage may explode or whatever happens. But they're on a different track. They literally have to back the train up to where they missed the switch, throw the switch, and get back on a different track and recognize that the backing up process is learning, and all Christians are to learn what God says in all things in life, to learn their God-given roles. I want to say that. I wanted to stress all of that before we go on. And part one and part two and part three all talked about it from different perspectives. Now we're ready for point three here, part three. to the ladies. Ladies, point three, fulfill the little needs in your marriage that are going unfulfilled. Fulfill the little needs in your marriage that are going unfulfilled. Genesis chapter 2. I'm going to put all these things in booklet form. We need a booklet of the practical side of marriage. Mr. Armstrong wrote the one about why marriage soon obsolete. We have, you know, the purpose of marriage ever obsolete, which reflects the overview of marriage. But we need another one on the practical side of marriage, which other authors wrote in the past. And that's actually my next book, with divorce and remarriage to follow that. Genesis chapter 2, and we'll pick it up in verse 18. Now again, and the Lord God said, it's not good that the man should be alone. I'll make a help meet for him. And out of the ground the Lord formed every beast of the field and so forth. I will make a help meet for him. She's an assistant to him, a help fit for him. It meets the requirements, is sort of the sense of the old English there, the translation. A help suitable or fit for him. It does not say, now this is not point two, because it's point three, and it's a separate point, but it's related. She is a help, an assistant to him. One of the greatest ways you can do that is to see the little things that are going unfulfilled in your husband's life. You and in the marriage and with the children, in every way in that sense. What are the little things that are being missed? Men were not designed to see those things. You say, oh, you're saying women, I'm being facetious, I know you're not saying this. Oh, does that mean women are more picky? No. No, it doesn't mean that. Women can see little things that men simply can't see. They just do. Men miss certain points. And when you put them together, remember, two are better than one. Remember, we read that in Ecclesiastes 4. If the man was designed by God to see the big picture, and the woman was more designed by God to see the small points, that doesn't make one better than the other. It means that when they're put together, they see the big and the little points, as long as each recognizes what their natural tendencies are. Now, there are men who tend to see little details, and that's fine. Doesn't mean if you're a man, you can't see anything small or any picky things or can't get your tie straight or part your hair right or you put your coat on backwards and your left foot shoes on your right and so forth. Well, I'm a man. That's all right. And I comb my hair with a fan, you know. You look like Einstein when he combed his hair. Actually, he looked like he combed it with a fan and then stuck two fingers in a socket at the same time. And, you know, he had that look. You know, I'm a brilliant man look, and here's how you know it. My hair looks like a hand grenade went off in it. It's a funny thing about how brilliant people are supposed to look like their thinking is somehow strangely skewed at the same time. But it's the way it is. Think of it this way. The man is sort of the chairman of the board, the president, the king, the prime minister, or the captain, if you will. The woman is sort of the queen, the secretary of state, the foreign minister, if you will, which is, I guess, equivalent to secretary of state, and a princess, I guess, besides. She's a vice president. The husband's a two-star general. In a sense, she is a colonel, and she may need to be a colonel to the kids, who are all buck privates, if we're going to follow the analogy through. In many ways, think of it this way. If the husband is the president, then the woman is the vice president, and in certain senses, the secretary, the treasurer, the general counselor, and personal manager at home. It sounds like you gave all the authority to the woman. No, no. Her job is to see all the little things that the lesser offices behind any great leader have to be taken care of. That's not a joke, what I'm trying to say there. It's very important. There are lots of little needs that your husband will not see. He will not always even see that you fulfilled them, because he won't see that there was even a need for one to do that. But your reward will be with and from God, ladies, if you understand that it's your natural responsibility to take care of these little needs that every marriage and family has. You know, being sure your husband's shirts look good. My wife takes care of those things. She just thinks about it. Incredible. I go in there and I'm never out of shirts. You know, everything's washed and so forth. She's on the internet the other day ordering. I just mumbled one time, I need more black socks. And boom, she gets them on the internet, just the right kind and another pair besides. There are ways that every wife can do better in that way. What little things does your marriage need? My wife has grown in that way. All women grow in that way. You don't figure that out at first. But keep thinking about what are the little things that you can bring to your marriage that your husband was not programmed by God to see. Number four, ladies, your husband is under pressure. Understand, tolerate, and accept him. Understand, tolerate, and accept him. Sometimes that pressure, by the way, will cause him to miss certain things. Back to point three. He won't necessarily have his tie straight. He might put on a suit that is spotted or something, or he has certain idiosyncrasies when he's under pressure. And you have to see those little needs. But in this case, I'm focusing on understand, tolerate, and accept him. Proverbs chapter 11. Proverbs 11. Whoops, I think I wrote the wrong verse down. Well, it's a good point. Has to do with women. Just can't figure out why it's there unless it's by accident. But since you're in Proverbs 11, read verse 22. As a jewel of gold in a swine snout, so is a fair woman which is without discretion. It's a great point for some sermon. We're there, we might as well say it. I don't know what verse I did have down, so please forgive me. But we'll move on because we're running behind. I have some longer stories that we have to cover. Number five, encourage your husband to success, but do it gently. There's a fine line between driving and pressing and pushing your husband and encouraging your husband. Now, perhaps the greatest gift any woman can give her husband, and I would add her not-so-secure husband, men are not nearly as secure as they seem, is to tell him that he's wonderful. Mr. Pack, do you know my husband? Tell him he's wonderful. Find a way to do it, because your husband may rise, just as women will rise to what husbands inspire them to be. Your husband may rise to what you encourage him to be. Look at 1 Kings 21, quite a remarkable statement here about a rather not famous but infamous marriage. 1 Kings chapter 21, the marriage of Ahab and Jezebel. And Ahab, verse 20, 1 Kings 21, Ahab said to Elijah, "Have you found me, O my enemy?" And he answered, "I have found you because you have sold yourself to work evil in the sight of the Lord." Now, that's quite a statement. It sets up what we're going to read. "Behold, I will bring evil upon you and will take away your posterity," and God's pretty blunt here, "and will cut off from Ahab him that pisses against the wall." Well, that, women don't do that. Men do. I mean, those are God's words. I don't apologize for it. God is blunt. If more people appreciated that God means what he says and he bluntly says what he says, it would go a lot better for all people on planet Earth, and certainly for those of us in the church. "And him that is shut up and left in Israel, and will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah, for the provocation wherewith you have provoked me to anger and made Israel to sin. And of Jezebel also spoke the Lord, saying, the dogs shall eat Jezebel by the wall of Jezreel." What a horrible way to die, or to end. She died before that. "Him that dies of Ahab in the city, the dogs shall eat. And him that dies in the field shall the fowls of the air eat." This is an evil man. But notice what happened. "But there was none like unto Ahab, which did sell himself to work wickedness in the sight of the Lord." And here's this famous statement written here by God, left to all women by God for a great purpose. You'll see what it is. Whom Jezebel, his wife, stirred up. And the margin says incited. Yes, Ahab was accountable for what he did. He was responsible. He goes, oh, that's all my wife's fault. You know, Adam, blame Eve. Actually, in some ways, even though Eve caused the problem and no doubt stirred Adam to eat the fruit with her, the Bible says that Adam was more accountable than Eve because he wasn't deceived and she was. So in a sense, you know, there's no doubt about it, Ahab bore his sin. But still, somewhere in there, this one of the most evil men of all time was stirred up and incited to some degree and in some fashion by this evil woman. Now, the flip side of that, remember, 1 Corinthians 10:11 says, these stories are written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the world have come. The message there is that if a woman can stir up her husband to evil because that's his natural proclivity, he wasn't a wonderful, righteous man, and it was all her fault. She just turned him into the most, you know, evil king of all time, in Israel at least. But in fact, if a man's natural proclivity is toward righteousness and accomplishment, achievement, and success, a woman can enhance that and stir him up and can inspire him. You can encourage your husband to success. You can stir him. You can give him a daily, as we would say in Spokesman Club, stir to action speech. Everybody's responsible for what they do, but great leaders influence and encourage and stir others. I've seen marriages, counseled different marriages. I remember two marriages back in the 70s that I counseled, one in New York and one in New Jersey, the first time I was sent there for 11 months or so, about 1976. And I remember counseling this one woman who actually was a man and a woman who were in the church, each married to a woman and a man not in the church, if you can follow that. The man was a deacon at the time, and he couldn't get his marriage to work out. He was a deacon, and his wife wasn't in the church, and he just oppressed her something awful, and I couldn't get him to back off. He wanted so badly for his marriage to work. There was room for his marriage to work, but he wouldn't back off. I'll just never forget that perhaps first time early in my ministry was in that particular kind of situation. A man so wanted the marriage to work, the woman wanted it to work, and the man was asking for help, but not really asking like he should have, and in the end he drove his wife out. She could not live with his oppression. Now the case of the other woman, who was in the church, her husband was willing to live with her. She lived in a magnificent home in New Jersey. She had a lifestyle that was fantastic. Her mother was also in the church and lived with her. And her husband, not in the church, remember, was willing to let her mother live there. And this woman wouldn't let up on her husband. She'd call me and describe what was going on. I could tell just from her side of it, without hearing his side of it, I could tell that she was oppressing him and ruining this incredible situation she had. But she couldn't back off. She just drove him and pushed him and pushed him and eventually lost her marriage and lost a place for her mother to live in a beautiful home. And of course, both those marriages caused terrible problems for the children who were wounded as a result. There were children in both marriages. Turn to Genesis 24, going over this verse, story. It's kind of an amazing story of an arranged marriage. I don't know that I have time to go into all of it. I wish I did. It's an incredibly long chapter. 67 verses in the chapter, probably one of the longest chapters in the Bible, but it's a story of Isaac's wife, Rebekah, being selected from afar because she was of his ethnic background. People often misunderstand the story. She was of a similar people. So God had to have the promise of seed to Abraham and the twofold promise of both spiritual salvation through Christ descended from Judah, as well as, of course, the birthright promises through the sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. And after the promise was made to Abraham, now here comes Isaac, And of course, the promise was recommitted to Isaac and later Jacob. A little problem, though, there wasn't going to be a Jacob if there wasn't a wife to Isaac. And so this is a remarkable story, one of the most remarkable stories, really. Maybe even a little bit of insight into how, to some degree, things will happen in the millennium. But you had, not like the Chinese, but you had an arranged marriage where this extraordinary woman, yes, she had weaknesses. You know, Rebecca conspired with Jacob to steal the birthright from Esau and so forth. She had weaknesses, no doubt about that. Rebecca, in a certain sense, was a type of the church. Mr. Armstrong always taught that. As a matter of fact, that appeared in America and Britain, and I touch on it in the book as well. But here she was, this extraordinary woman was willing to marry a man sight unseen. Would you do that? Yes, she had her weaknesses. They decided, in effect, and this is the way it is with every arranged marriage, they made the decision to love each other. Now, most marriages, of course, are a byproduct of people checking out and seeing, are we interested? How would this work? What are your interests? What are my interests? What are our backgrounds? Are we compatible? How do we feel? Are we attracted to each other, et cetera? And all, forget all that. Just forget it all. Here's this woman who has never met Isaac. She's told about him. This isn't The Bachelor and The Bachelorette. You know, and they have this junk on television. I've never seen any of them. And yet one-third of all Americans, they now estimate one-third of all Americans watch this trash, where at least they meet each other. You know, at least they talk to each other. None of that, just none of it. It was sort of an arranged marriage. And she said, I will come. I will come and I will be Isaac's wife. Now, that's a woman who understood the enormous role of a woman as an assistant to make this man, this unusual man she'd been told about, who was one of the fathers. The Bible describes Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, even though they were father, you know, son, and grandson, technically. They are all called the fathers. They're all the patriarchs, not just Abraham. They're all the patriarchs. God specifically made unique promises to all three of them. Then from then on, this sort of three generations of a one-man nation, as Mr. Armstrong called it, expanded to 12, and it was after Israel's generation, the great-grandsons of Abraham, that all of a sudden now this nation began to appear. But it was one extraordinary man followed by one extraordinary man followed by one extraordinary man, all of whom did some not-so-good things, particularly Abraham and Jacob. And God had to change them. Abraham did some terrible things, frankly. Jacob did some things that were even worse. And yet this enormous number of billions of people, Bible prophecy was thousands of millions, came from this man, and they're all called Israelites. They're not called Abrahamites or Isaacites. The term Saxon, Isaac's sons, comes from it to a degree, but still they're called Israelites, these extraordinary people. So Isaac and Rebekah were extraordinary people, and they had an extraordinary son. This arranged marriage produced one of the greatest servants of God of all time. Now what if she said no? No, I don't do that. I want to get to know him. I want to court him and date him. It wouldn't have worked. You ought to take time to read the chapter. I don't have time to read it. It's an extraordinary chapter. When I've given this sermon before, I went through and it shows how the thinking worked there. I just wish I had more time to go through. Point number 6. Let me just stress again before we go on. Ladies, I cannot tell you enough how important it is that you support and understand and recognize your ability to influence your husband for right or wrong. And my wife learned this. She did. She understood as a minister's wife, and she, in many ways God selected her a long, long time ago for me, and I hope me for her. I really do believe that because I know now of where I am in my life. I have this unusual lady who seems to know what not to tell me, or if she does, how to tell me what she tells me. You know, how what not to tell me, how not to tell me the things she does, and how she knows she can press my buttons. You ladies can press your husband's buttons. and you can press the wrong buttons, every husband's got them, and you can press the right buttons, and every husband's got them. And it's your job to figure out which buttons you ought to just put a piece of tape over. And just don't hit that one like a light switch. You ever turn that one off, you know, the heater shuts down or something in the basement, or you got these switches in some certain houses. Don't hit that one. And the other one, press regularly. Well, there are ladies who know how to press their husband's buttons all right, but you got to be sure you press the right one, not the wrong one. Every woman will press the wrong one from time to time. Number six, this is a counterpart of an earlier point. Strive to grow with your husbands in sexual understanding. Now, there's not going to be a whole lot that needs to be said here because we talked about it, but it is important to understand, ladies, you may have been, you may be the child of a very loose mother, all the way to a mother who was a Victorian prude in the extreme. Believe me when I tell you this, you are more a product of your mother than you can know. You are more a product of your mother than you can possibly know. There's so much out there, scrambled thinking on sex. You can't pick up one of these women's magazines. You can't pick up, you can't go into a bookstore without seeing tons and tons and tons of books, so sex manuals out there. And of course, I realize I've got to write a book on this subject. But so many people are scrambled. I've seen some incredible advice given by some of God's ministers. I think the worst advice I ever heard, and this will shock you, brethren, you better fasten your seatbelt, but it'll show you how people can get fouled up. I went into an assignment one time in the past and listened to the following. A whole series of women came to me and wanted to tell me advice and things that had happened to them when the previous minister was there. But the most shocking thing I think I have ever heard was a woman, I'm sitting in a restaurant, my wife's right there, and this woman said she wanted to report to me, now that the minister's gone, and she wanted to bring me up to speed on what was going on in her marriage. She said, I just wanted to report to you, you know, where things are. I've had a lot of marriage problems, my husband and I were counseling. Now, he wasn't in the church, but he was friendly, and he played on the softball team, and he knew the minister and came to church often. Nice guy. I met him later. But she said, we had marriage problems. I said, well, what did the minister actually counsel? He said, well, the minister counseled us to commit adultery. I said, incredible. Well, you obviously didn't do it. She said, oh, we did. I said, what? You both committed adultery? Now, if you think that's bad, she said, oh, but it was good advice. It worked. It saved our marriage. Now, I cite that story, that appalling, outrageous abomination. And the day I replaced that minister is the last day he ever came into the church. That wasn't even the worst thing he did. But he literally counseled a couple who were appallingly blind and foolish and stupid and reckless enough to go out and do that, and then in the end think you had wisdom. Now, I'll tell you that story because it shows you how God's people can be incredibly blind. Yes, reckless, yes, foolish, yet just blind. And they won't understand how God works in marriage. Had I not been sitting there, my wife will never forget it. Had I not been sitting there and heard it, if anybody told me that story, it couldn't be true. And there's no reason for a woman to make up a story like that. And I talked with her husband later, and he verified it. They both went out and did it. This was back when swinging began to be, in vogue. And the minister said, hey, well, maybe that works. Shows you that we had some ministers that maybe weren't converted back then, being facetious, of course. There has to be a right understanding. Again, I'll just say it's why that book that Mr. Armstrong wrote was so important for Ambassador College students. It was mainly a manual for students, and that's why I'll say again, it won't be as long. My version of The Missing Dimension in Sex will not be as long as Mr. Armstrong's, but it is crucial to understand that a lack of proper sexual understanding in a world that's drowning in all kinds of wrong knowledge, programming people in wrong ways about sex, You know, and from God's perspective, the right knowledge is so vital, so vital. Point seven. Avoid nagging and criticizing your husband at all costs. Avoid nagging and criticizing him at all costs. Proverbs 21. And verse 9. It is better to dwell in the corner of a housetop than with a brawling woman in a wide house. Now, it's a woman of contentions. I don't think any man would want to dwell with a brawling woman either. I remember one of the most famous cases. I heard about this woman who was arrested for assaulting her husband. I thought, come on, what kind of man could have a woman assault him? And I saw a picture of him. He looked like Barney Fife, and she looked like, she looked like a tank without the treads. And so I will say that I looked at it and said, well, okay, I guess it is possible a woman could brawl and beat up her husband. And they say there are more and more cases of this happening, women assaulting their husbands because they become strong, they bodybuild, and it's another one of the fouled up things in this world. But that's not what this is talking about. It's talking about a woman of contentions, a contentious woman. You can't get away, even in a wide house, a big house, you can't get away from a woman who nags and criticizes. Chapter 27. And some women do. You know, some women do. They have no idea what they're doing. A continual dropping, verse 15. In a very rainy day, and a contentious woman are alike. Continual dropping. You know, it's called the Chinese water torture. You know, drip, 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 drip. When they use the term, you wonder where the term comes from. He's a drip. This is it. That's true. That's a true story. This word comes from, he's a real drip. You know, just drip, 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 drip. Only in this case, it's talking about women. She's a real drip, I guess, would be the more accurate reflection of the statement. A continual dropping in a very rainy day. You know, the Chinese water torture is horrible because what happens is, and they understand this psychologically. They didn't get it from the Proverbs, I doubt, but certainly God says it too. So let me explain it. Let me explain how it works. The Chinese water torture works this way. They will put a person in a tower or a dungeon, but where there are concrete walls around the person, and a drop of water will strike the head at controlled intervals, generally about 1 minute. Within several days, the person is totally insane. That's the famous Chinese water torture, and here's why. As the drip comes, for a while it's just a drip on the head, but what happens is the senses become heightened to it. And the anticipation, because it's at exactly 1 minute intervals, eventually what drives the person insane is that when the water, after a couple of days, strikes the person's head, every time it strikes, there's an explosion of sound, an absolute explosion, like a giant bell ringing. And the buildup, the psyche becomes, and I'll come to my point, the psyche is built up in such a way, the anticipation, when it comes, boom, it hits that loud. And then it just builds up until the person is eventually insane. And then they would often execute them at that point after they tortured them. All right. When nagging occurs in a marriage, it has almost the exact same effect. There is a buildup of pressure where the person who is being nagged gets to where they anticipate it, and it rubs them raw, and it rubs them raw. It rubs them more and more raw, just a continual dripping. You've heard dripping, drip, 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 constant nagging until eventually it will destroy the best marriage. Avoid nagging and criticizing your husband at all costs, at all costs. Whosoever, verse 16, hides her, hides the wind and the ointment of his right hand, which bewrays itself. You know, if you can get rid of that woman, you can hide the wind. In other words, it's extremely hard to stop the pattern of nagging. about as easy as hiding the wind. Remarkable proverb. Here's a practical effect. 2 Samuel chapter 6. How does God feel about it? How does God feel about a woman who nags? Does the Bible tell us? Yes, it does. 2 Samuel chapter 6 and verse 12. And it was told King David, saying, 2 Samuel 6:12, the Lord has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that pertains unto him because of the ark of God. So David went and brought up the ark of God from the city of Obed-Edom into the city of David with gladness. And it was so that when they bore the ark of the Lord and had gone 6 paces, he sacrificed oxen and fatlings. I mean, that's an amazing story. I mean, in terms of David's thrill, I mean, wow, the ark of God is back. Well, it continues, David danced before the Lord with all his might. Would you do this? Would you? God says he was a man after his own heart. All the apostles, the 12 apostles, will report directly to David over the 12 tribes of Israel. One of the truly great servants of God of all time. Now look at how he did what he did here. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of a trumpet. Oh, that doesn't seem elegant for a king to do that, to dance. And the ark of the Lord came into the city of David. Now Michal, Saul's daughter, looked through a window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart. Now apparently he took off some clothes, so he didn't get naked or anything like that, but he took off some clothes so that he could move more freely. And they brought in the ark of the Lord and set it on its place in the midst of the tabernacle that David had pitched for it. And David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And as soon as David had made an end of offering burnt offerings and peace offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts. And he dealt among all the people, even among the whole multitude of Israel, as well as to the women and men, to everyone a cake of bread and a good piece of flesh and a flagon of wine. So all the people departed, every one to his house. Then David returned to bless his household, and Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, now, this was no compliment. How glorious, this is sarcastic. How glorious was the king of Israel today who uncovered himself today in the eyes of the handmaids of his servants as one of the vain fellows, shamelessly uncovering himself. She didn't mean just uncovering his conduct, although I guess she would consider it that way too. And David said unto Michal, it was before the Lord which chose me before your father, ooh, and before all his house to appoint me ruler over the people of the Lord over Israel. Therefore will I play before the Lord. Now play, in a sense, dance, be exuberant, happy, you know, blow a trumpet, sing, offer sacrifices, and just play like a little kid, in a sense, before the Lord. And I will yet be more vile than thus. Now, he's coming back with his own sarcastic response, because that wasn't being vile, but that's the way she would have viewed it. And will be base in my own sight. And of the maidservants which you have spoken of them shall I be had in honor. You misread them. They see better than you do, and you're my wife. The response, because of one nagging, perhaps there was a pattern that preceded this, and this was the straw that broke the camel's back, I don't know. Therefore, Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child until the day of her death. How important is nagging to God or not doing it? Very important. She picked at him or criticized him. Might be a better way there. Avoid nagging and criticizing your husband at all costs. Now, if you're a wise husband, let me tell you something, a little aside to you. I would urge you, and turn back now to 1 Samuel 25, I would urge you, you husbands, ask your wife periodically how you can grow. Ask your wife, is there anything that I can do? How can I better grow? What better example can I serve? You know, what would you have me do? How can I learn in some way? You know, what do you see? Now, if your wife's not in the church, fasten your seatbelt. But if she is in the church, I don't know, maybe fasten it more, depending upon how much she sees spiritually with the eyes of God. But I hope that the wife would be careful. But I'll just say again, ask your wife. But you know what? If your husband doesn't ask you, unless your husband is hurting you or hurting the children, in some way he is hurting you or hurting the children, do not go tell him how he needs to be better. The wise husband, any husband who doesn't do this is just flat out not wise. The wise husband asks his wife for more, but it is not your job to go criticize your husband unless somebody is being hurt directly. Then your Christian responsibility overrides that. There are examples of extraordinary women. Here is one, 1 Samuel chapter 25. And Samuel died, and all the Israelites were gathered together and lamented him and buried him in his house at Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. And there was a man in Maon whose possessions were in Carmel. And the man was very great, and he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now his name was Nabal. And now the name of the man was Nabal. That means, that's translated, fool. I don't know who would name their son fool. What's your name, fool? My name is Fool. What a name. I mean, and the name of his wife, Abigail. And she was a woman of good understanding and of a beautiful countenance. So here's a beautiful, talented, let's say also a spiritually capable person, converted person, maybe. I don't know. Probably not, but unusual in terms of understanding. And she's married to this man who, it says, was churlish and evil in his doings. And I mean, his name is Fool. And he was of the house of Caleb. Now this is interesting. First of all, there are women who make mistakes, fine, decent, in this case also, I guess you'd add, attractive women, who can marry somebody who is just a terrible husband. It happens. It's worse when that happens than it's the other way around, because at least the man is in charge. But now when you marry a terrible husband, you're also under him. God's plan for the family doesn't suddenly go away. And David heard in the wilderness that Nabal did shear his sheep. And David sent out 10 young men. And David said to the young men, get you up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus shall you say to him that lives in prosperity, peace be both to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be unto all that you have. And now I have heard that you have shearers. Now your shepherds, which were with us, we hurt them not, neither was there aught missing unto them all the while they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will show you. Wherefore, let the young men find favor in your eyes. For we come in a good day. I'm just going to read through the story. Give, I pray you, whatsoever comes to your hand unto your servants and to your son David. We've been good to you. How would he feel about that? When David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all of these words in the name of David, and then they ceased. And Nabal answered David's servants and said, who is David? What? And who is the son of Jesse? Well, as in, he's king. There be many servants nowadays that break away from their master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my flesh that I've killed for my shearers and give it unto men whom I know not whence they be? This guy was a fool. So David's young men turned their way and went again and came and told him all those sayings. And David said unto his men, gird on every man his sword. David, let's get him. And they're not going to talk to me that way. Well, that's not necessarily the best attitude from David. And they girded on every man his sword. David also girded on his sword. And they went up after David, about 400 men, and 200 abode by the stuff. By the stuff. I was reading an article in USA Today this week about how people, the national pastime in America is to accumulate stuff. You know, people say, this is all my stuff here. This is your stuff. This is my stuff. Well, there it is. It's called stuff. They abode by the stuff. It's actually there in the Bible. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to salute your master, and he railed on them. You know, the margin is he flew on them. You know, he flew into a rage. They use that term. You've heard it. Comes from the Bible. But the men were very good unto us, and we were not hurt, neither missed we anything, as long as we were conversant with them when we were in the fields. They were a wall unto us both by night and day, and all the while we were with them keeping the sheep. Now therefore know and consider what you will do, for evil is determined against our master and against all his household, for he's such a son of Belial that a man cannot speak to him. Then Abigail made haste on behalf of her husband and took 200 loaves and 2 bottles of wine and 5 sheep ready dressed. You have to really move to prepare all this. and 5 measures of parched corn, 100 clusters of raisins, and 200 cakes of figs, and laid them on asses. And she said unto her servants, go on before me, behold, I come after you. But she told not her husband Nabal. She's, I guess, technically obedient, didn't tell him, but she saved his life. And it was so as she rode on the ass that she came down to the cover of the hill, and behold, David and his men came down against her, and she met him. Now David had said, surely in vain have I kept all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that pertained unto him, and he has requited me evil for good. Now, you know, you don't go kill him, but still in a way, you can understand David's anger. So and more also do God unto the enemies of David, if I leave of all that pertains to him by the morning, night, any that pisses against the wall. There it is again. And when Abigail saw David, she hasted and lighted off the ass and fell before David on her face and bowed herself to the ground. She didn't say, wow, good, I got a chance to get out of this marriage of this just churlish, foolish, evil son of Belial monster. No, look at what she did. And fell at his feet and said, upon me, my Lord, upon me let this iniquity be, and let your handmaid, extraordinary character here, I pray you speak in your audience and hear the words of your handmaid. Let not, my Lord, I pray you, regard this man of Belial. She knows exactly what her husband is. She didn't say, no, you misunderstand him, and then she lies and covers for him. She says, he's a son of Belial, man of even Nabal, the fool. For as his name is, so is he. I'm married to him, I know. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your handmaid, saw not the young men of your Lord whom you did send. And anyway, David decided not to kill this man. In verse 32, and David said to Abigail, blessed be the Lord God of Israel, which sent you this day to meet me. And blessed be your advice, and blessed be you, which has kept me this day from coming to shed blood and from avenging myself with my own hand. For in very deed, as the Lord God of Israel lives, which God kept me back from hurting you, except you had hasted, and she moved fast, extraordinary story, except you had hasted, come to meet me, surely there had not been left unto Nabal by the morning. He wasn't just going to kill Nabal, as everybody was even connected to him. So David perceived of her hand that which she had brought him, and said unto her, go up in peace to your house. See, I have heard your voice, and have accepted your person. And Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he held a feast in his house like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him. He was drunken, and wherefore she told him nothing, less or more, until the morning light. But it came to pass in the morning, when the wine was gone out of Nabal, and his wife had told him these things, that his heart died within him, and it became as a stone. And it came to pass after about 10 days that the Lord smote Nabal and he died. I mean, he just had a heart attack. That's what it says. He had a heart attack. So here is an example of one opposite to Michael. And frankly, Abigail went on to be David's wife. Perhaps was the wife that Michael never would be. Avoid nagging and criticizing, ladies, your husbands at all costs. Point number 8. You are a reflection of your husband. If you don't like your husband, you are a reflection of him. You will reflect him. If you want to improve yourself because you are a reflection of your husband, then improve your husband. Encourage him to be all that he is. But a virtuous woman, it says, is a crown to her husband. That's what you are supposed to be. You're not a crown to yourself. You're a crown to your husband. But she that makes ashamed is as rottenness in his bones. All women are, literally, of one sort or another, a crown to their husbands. They can be the proverbial crown of thorns, a thorn in his side and on his head, or they can be, and you can turn over to 1 Corinthians 11, or they can literally be a crown to him in the true, beautiful sense of the word. You know, that meek and quiet spirit that is a crown on the woman's head, but also, since she is married, it becomes to a certain degree a crown also on his head. 1 Corinthians chapter 11. I believe we talked about this, but I'm going to come back to it. For the woman, verse 6, 1 Corinthians 11, be not covered, let her be shorn, but if it be a shame for a woman to be shorn or shaven, let her be covered. Well, of course, it is a shame for a woman to be shorn or shaven, so she should be covered, not just hair long enough that God would describe it as uncovered. I've discussed in other times how these are four different hair lengths, shaven, shorn, uncovered, and covered. For a man indeed ought not to cover his head, for as much as he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of the man. Well, that's absolutely consistent with Proverbs 12 and verse 4. The man is not the glory of the woman. The woman wants a little more glory, then enhance in every way you can this man who is your head. But recognize the way to increase your own glory is to increase his. It's to increase his. The more you increase his, since you are the crown on his head, you literally exalt yourself. Do you understand that, ladies? If you truly try to exalt yourself, you'll be abased. That's the scriptures in so many other ways in the Christian walk anyway. But if you try to elevate yourself in your marriage, you'll ruin your marriage, and you misunderstand your God-ordained role to be a reflection of your husband. All right, so when people see you, they are now then supposed to be looking into a mirror of your husband's character. So then I would ask you, ladies, God asks you, what is your character? What is the reflection in the mirror? We're supposed to be able to see your husband when we see you, if you are in fact a reflection of him. Now, you may not have a husband who knows how to make you his glory, encourage you to become his glory. You could be married to a Nabal. They are out there. But that doesn't mean you cannot be an Abigail and still be a reflection. Your husband can rise. Remember, you can be an Abigail married to a Nabal, or a Jezebel married to a Nabal like Ahab. The Bible shows both examples. You can be a Ruth who says, whither thou goest, I go. Or you can be a Michael who said, boy, did you shame yourself today. Final point. Discuss your problems with your husband, but rely on God. No man can work out his wife's salvation. No man can do that. Of course, no woman can work out her husband's salvation. She can enhance and inspire him to a degree, but no man can do that to his wife. You must rely on God. Your husband can counsel you. He can encourage you. We've talked about that in other ways. Proverbs 31 says your husband trusts you. You know, you ought to be willing to trust him with your spiritual questions. Paul told the Corinthians in chapter 14, told the women, you know, ask your husband's questions at home. You should discuss your problems with your husband. But don't rely on him. You work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. You're not going to be under your husband in the kingdom of God. I don't care what the Mormons think. I suppose God could do it in some extraordinary circumstance. It's not like it's wrong to do it. The Bible doesn't say, you know, that it could never happen. But this is a training ground. You know, there is no marriage in the kingdom of God. God is very plain about that. We're like the angels. The marriage is in this life to learn the lesson of how God is, in fact, expanding his family. He's reproducing himself. The whole concept of husband, wife, Christ and the church. The church is our mother. You know, one of the great heresies that's going on out there, and I think maybe I said this a few weeks ago, I've talked about it. One of the large, you know, the leaders teaches that the church is not our mother, which absolutely denies the plain, unmistakable meaning of Galatians 4:29 and Hebrews 12:22-3, which flat out says, without any interpretation, the church is our mother. So that great purpose is being worked out in the physical home. The physical home. But at the same time, it ends in marriage. Your husband is not, you're not going to report to him in the kingdom of God. You have to stand on your own feet spiritually now. You have to counsel with him regarding your problems, but you rely on God now. You have to work out your own salvation with fear and trembling before God now. No husband and no wife can save each other. You may call your husband Lord, as we talked about, 1 Peter 3:6, but at the same time, God is truly your Lord. And if you don't call your husband Lord, you should certainly think of your husband as Lord. Turn to 1 Samuel chapter 1. 1 Samuel chapter 1. Quite an inspiring story. And there was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim of Mount Ephraim. He's an Ephraimite. And his name was Elkanah, eventual father of Samuel, the son of Jehoram, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zoph, an Ephrathite. And he had two wives. And the name of the one was Hannah. The name of the other was Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. And this man went up out of the city yearly to worship and to sacrifice unto the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. When the time was that Elkanah offered, he gave to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons and her daughters portions. Lots of children. Be tough for Hannah. She has no children, but she lived with it. And so did Elkanah. But unto Hannah, he said, a worthy portion, a double portion, if you look at it. Look in the margin. A double portion he gave to this woman who had no children than to the woman who had all the children. For he loved Hannah, but the Lord had shut her womb. Now, in other words, he didn't say, well, you gave me all these children, Peninnah, so you get a lot more than this woman who's been barren. Wouldn't be her fault. In this particular case, anybody who would conclude that it was her fault, you know, she didn't take care of herself in poor health or whatever, would have been wrong, because it says the Lord had shut up her womb. And her adversary also provoked her sore. Well, who was that? Peninnah. For to make her fret because the Lord had shut up her womb. A terrible attitude on the part of Peninnah. And as he did so, year by year, when she went up to the house of the Lord, so she provoked her, no doubt, because here's the woman with no kids getting a double portion perhaps every year. And the woman who was blessed with all these wonderful children has no compassion, but just must have focused on staying preeminent and maybe angry that Elkanah was loyal to this woman who didn't bear many sons and daughters and just unappreciative. Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why weep you? And why eat you not? And why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? But he misunderstood her, but in a sense, a wonderful, you know, concern. Misunderstanding, yes. You know, any man who would say that does not understand how women were put on earth in many ways to bear children. They are a type of the church. The church has children. God has children. So no husband's going to be better than 10 sons. He might be better than one son, who knows, but you can understand at least he's concerned. He's asking about her. So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh and after they had drunk. Now Eli the priest sat upon a seat by the post of the temple of the Lord, and she was in bitterness of soul and prayed unto the Lord and wept sore. And she vowed a vow and said unto the Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your handmaid. See, she never left him. And remember me and not forget your handmaid, but will give unto your handmaid a man child, then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. Here's a remarkable statement. She vows this Nazarite vow on behalf of the one who would, of course, become one of the great servants who ever came, Samuel. And it came to pass as she continued praying before the Lord that Eli marked her mouth. Now Hannah, she spoke in her heart, but her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli thought she was drunk. And Eli said to her, how long will you be drunk? Put away the wine from you. And Hannah answered and said, O my Lord, I am a woman of a sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but have poured out my soul to the Lord. Count not your handmaid a daughter of Belial, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken in this way. Then Eli answered and said, go in peace, and the God of Israel grant you your petition that you have asked him. And she said, let your handmaid find grace in your sight. She rose up in the morning early and worshipped before the Lord. unusual woman, and returned and came to her house to Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah's wife, and the Lord remembered her. Of course, they had relations. I didn't mean he knew her. He didn't know her before that. Who are you? Well, remember, we just talked yesterday. What do you mean? You don't know me? I mean, the King James is just so funny. You obviously don't share the humor, but just he knew his wife. Bore a son and called his name Samuel, which means asked of God, Elohim. Samuel asked of God, because I have asked him of the Lord. And, of course, Samuel went on to fulfill this extraordinary role. Once you know the truth, marriage is for life. It's for life. Somebody handed me this list of sayings. Too many couples marry for better or for worse, but not for good. And that's so much the case. Elkanah didn't say, I'll get rid of her. He treated her. He gave her a double portion, and she couldn't give him children. He didn't say, well, that's the way I measure it. He was wonderful to her. And on the other hand, you can begin to understand why when you look at her. She sought God. She had a wonderful attitude. She was faithful. And God, as a result, because she dedicated this, again, out of the closeness to God, she dedicated this child, God, through her, allowed to be born one of the great servants who ever came from a woman. God had shut up her womb for a special purpose, and along came this little boy, asked of God, Samuel. Isn't it good that Elkanah and Hannah understood that marriage is for life, or there wouldn't have been a Samuel? There would not have been a Samuel. Marriage is for good. A few others here that are funny I might just stick in. When a man marries a woman, they become one, but the trouble starts when they try to decide which one. In this society, that's the case. Abigail would have said this one. Judging from the specimens they pick for husbands, it's no wonder that brides often blush. Obviously, this next one isn't said by a wise man. It says, a foolish husband remarks to his wife, honey, you stick to the washing, ironing, cooking, and scrubbing, because no wife of mine's going to work. Well, there's some others there. I appreciate that. Turn to Proverbs 18 and verse 22 before some final comments. I wrote down one time this saying from women, and some women, of course, are not married to good husbands. Your husband is a free moral agent in terms of his character development as much as you. Somebody once wrote this down, and it's true in some ways. It's sad when it's true in one of the marriages within God's church. We the willing, led by the unknowing, are doing the impossible for the ungrateful. We have done so much for so long with so little, we are now qualified to do anything with nothing. Kind of an interesting statement. Proverbs 18:22. Whoso finds a wife, not a woman, whoso finds a wife, a real wife, finds a good thing and obtains favor of the Lord. Both are blessed. Husbands appreciate it, wives fulfill it, but both are blessed. Anybody can go find a woman who supposedly will say, I do, you know, then you've got a wife, but truly a wife, not a Michael, but an Abigail, finds a good thing and obtains favor of the Lord. It's great advice to all people who are looking for someone to spend their life with. I'll tell you one thing. Whoever you marry, you better think character first. Both sides, character first. What is the person's character? I wanted to conclude with a few points, how people don't understand marriage. Here's a mix of different points from this Dr. William Nagler, this psychiatrist. Keeping sparks alive can burn out a marriage. He has certain points. Don't keep the romance alive. You can't stop trying. Is that right or wrong? That's wrong. But that's his advice. People would listen to stuff like that. That's what he advises. He advises, don't always tell the truth that requires total honesty and infinite tact. Both are impossible. Lie some. That's what people out there are hearing. Don't let go of the money, he advises the husband. Whosoever controls it controls the relationship. Split it into two accounts and take expenses from both equally. What kind of a relationship would that be? Don't worry about what you think is important. Worry about little things. They are what can do you in. You can see a little bit of value in worrying about little things, but don't worry about things that are important. I just wanted to cite some of these points. There's others. Don't ask about everything. Being totally honest usually makes matters worse. But you know what? Like that woman who counseled with her minister and trusted him, and he said, go commit adultery and it'll save your marriage. And she was foolish enough to do it, and then even more foolish enough to believe it after she did it. The tragedy is there are people that read this stuff, and they have no idea how to have a happy marriage. They don't even know if you can have a happy marriage because there's so much cynicism in those kinds of comments, and I just read you some of them, that no wonder people give in and give up. Here are some what I call some always points and then some never points. Always apologize when you are wrong on any count. Husbands and wives, always apologize when you are wrong on any count. Number two, always attempt to see things from the mate's point of view. Lincoln, the great president Abraham Lincoln, said, I always try to walk a mile in a man's moccasins before I judge him. Well, if that's true in other men, and certainly it's true in your marriage, try to see things from their point of view. Elkanah was sincere. He didn't really see Hannah's point of view. He's trying to be helpful. Always treat your mate as the most special person in your entire life. Always treat your mate as the most special person in your entire life. These also come from the world. I've sort of gleaned things down through the years and just put some of the comments down. They show you how you can get some helpful things, contrasted to what we read before. Always listen intently, finally, to what your mate is saying. I don't think you'd necessarily find those verses in the Bible, although it might say confess your faults one to another. They're in James 5, point one. But they're good principles. They're not wrong. They're very good principles. Here are some nevers. Now, these are points I have learned. These are points I have learned from counseling hundreds of marriages. Others have learned them too. Never put divorce on the table or threaten with it. Never put divorce on the table or threaten with it. Once it's on the table, it's now on the table forever. You can try to pull it back off the table, and it may never happen, but it now is always there between you. Don't ever put it on the table. If you have, the best thing you can do is apologize for it and never bring it up again. But you need to understand it's never quite the same. So never do it. Never store up feelings and then dump after you have. It's unfair. It's frankly, it's ungodly. But it's also unwise because it never works. Never store up feelings and then dump. And finally, there's just 3 points here. Never physically grab or attack each other, ever. First of all, the woman's the weaker vessel. She happens to be built like a weightlifter and he's Barney Fife. Well, then, okay, that's different, I suppose. And then it would be more to her than him. But never do that, ever do that. Some of you, do any of you remember the story in the 80s, about 87 or 8, the story of Hedda Nussbaum in New York? Any of you remember that her husband, Joel Steinberg, beat her up, killed their little girl? Famous story. Any of you remember it? Raise your hands if you remember the story. Okay, it was so big in the New York papers for a year, almost headlines for virtually a year. There were these stories of this woman who was beaten up and beaten up and beaten up. And they showed her pictures, bruised. He beat her from head to toe, killed their little girl, and she was buried right near where we were living in Pleasantville, New York at the time. And she's just about a mile from where we live. And I often think of this little 6-year-old girl that this attorney, Joel Steinberg, had murdered and then beaten up his wife, who kept her maiden name, Hedda Nussbaum. One time I was riding into the office, and I took a seat, and on the Metro North trains, it took about 90 minutes to ride in. Well, maybe that's a little high, 75 minutes you ride in with stops and so forth if you're on that train. And I sat directly opposite her. The seats faced each other, and there was Hedda Nussbaum. And for, we'll say, about 75 minutes or so, from 4 feet away, and there weren't many people on the train, and I just happened to take that seat because I wanted a seat where I could put my feet out. It was a little more space if the seats were opposite as opposed to they were right behind each other, all facing the same way. And I stared into the face of Hedda Nussbaum for 75 minutes. Her face was virtually destroyed. Her husband had beaten her up. She had her nose looked like a prize fighter. All the cartilage was gone from it. Now, she was long since healed. This was 2 or 3 years later, not long before I was transferred, maybe about 1989. And I rode there, and for 75 minutes, you know, I'd look down, look up, and I'd say, wow, this famous woman, Hedda Nussbaum, there she is. I rode in the train with a lot of famous people. I could tell you stories of who I saw on the train through the years I was in New York. Some of the different people I met, and even some of them came into the church, you'd know their names, famous people, movie stars, different ones. They're amazing. But here was this woman. I've never forgotten what can happen. She was a little woman, and her husband was 6'5", and he beat her to a pulp and ruined her face for life. Maybe plastic surgery could have repaired it, but what I saw 2 or 3 years later was something that will, you know, I'll never forget. You never, ever, ever touch each other. We had a rule in the ministry, and it was just unwritten law, and it was if a man touches a woman, he's automatically disfellowshipped. If he hits her, you don't even ask questions. You shoot first and then ask questions. You talk with him. From then on, the discussion is about how to come back to church because you're out. I had to do it a couple times, but that was a rule. Mr. Armstrong said any man who would hit a weaker vessel, he's out. You don't. There's no justification. And if you talk as though there is, you suggest there could be reason. So the first thing you do is disfellowship him. You ask no questions if he did it. From then on, everything is directed toward repentance and whether or not he can come back. That's how important it is that we understand who is the weaker vessel. You know, when you got married, if you got married in the church, but probably in the world, you were asked words that started something like this: do you faithfully promise? And the rest of the words are filled in. And at the end, you said, somewhere along the line in there, till death do you part, I do. In other words, you did. You vowed to do certain things. When you take a vow, and I could take 20 minutes to tell you how God views vows, a vow is a vow. Just like Hannah vowed this Nazarite vow for Samuel that was fulfilled. In fact, you took a vow. And that vow was till death do you part, to love, cherish, honor, provide for one, honor, the woman honors the husband. Marriage is a wonderful, wonderful institution as a type, frankly, of all that God is doing on planet Earth, particularly, of course, where there are children. Use it properly, use it wisely, as a very gift of God to those who understand why God gave it.